When you're a mom that's in litigation trying to protect your kids, you get so many messages that you're kind of revolting for your effort to fight for your kid. You know, you've got attorneys, even your own attorney so often is like, there's just something wrong with you, or you're being unreasonable, or you're being unfair, or this or that or the other thing. Of course, the abuser's attorney is acting like you're the most revolting thing on the planet. Custody evaluators often are talking in these extremely condescending, disrespectful ways. You're constantly being made to feel like you're the bad one. And so I'm very eager to tell moms, you are not the bad one. Your children desperately need you to be fighting for them the way you are. Someday they are almost certainly going to realize how valiantly you were fighting on their behalf.
Welcome to the Rising Beyond podcast, where you can find hope and healing after a toxic or abusive relationship. I'm Sybil Cummin, a licensed professional counselor specializing in working with victims and survivors of domestic violence and narcissistic abuse, including the youngest witnesses. Over the past decade, I have been honored to witness victims move to survivors and then to thriving in their lives. If you feel alone in your healing process, are dealing with the onslaught of post-separation abuse, or just needing some validation that you are not crazy, you are in the right place. Welcome to the Rising Beyond podcast. I'm Sybil Cummin, and my guest today needs no introduction. Today, I am talking with Lundy Bancroft on his thoughts on our family court system, on if Caden's Law and other similar laws will impact the system in the ways that we're really hoping for, and so much more. And so if you are new to the domestic violence and narcissistic abuse world, you do need to know who Lundy Bancroft is. So Lundy Bancroft has over 30 years of experience specializing in interventions for abusive men and their families. He has authored 7 books, including the world's bestseller on domestic violence, Why Does He Do That?, and the prize-winning professional book, The Batterer as Parent. Lundy is the former training director of Emerge, the U.S.'s first counseling program for men who batter, and was involved in over 2,000 cases as a counselor and clinical supervisor. He has served extensively as a custody evaluator, child abuse investigator, and expert witness. His new book and first novel, which we're going to talk about in this episode, it's called In Custody, A Cary Green Mystery, in which domestic violence meets the family law system. Y'all, this was such a fun episode for me. We had a great conversation. I hope you enjoy it and get as much out of it as I did. Lundy, thank you so much for joining us on the Rising Beyond podcast today.
Thank you, Sybil.
Yeah, so I don't feel like I need to share a ton about you because I believe that the majority of our listeners do know who you are. But if you can share a little bit about how you moved into the world of not only supporting survivors of domestic violence and being really outspoken, but now into post-separation abuse and what the family court system looks like and how that is just extensions of abuse.
So I came into domestic violence on the offender end. I was originally a counselor for the batterers, for men who abuse women. And fortunately, I was associated with programs, primarily with this program in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Emerge, that required that we be in contact with the victim of the abuse, whether the man was still with her or not, so we would get the real story on what he was all about. Because otherwise, the people who are doing abuse counseling without contact with the woman just get manipulated. Because these guys are so manipulative, and they just become another target for manipulation. And they'll start to say things to me like, oh, I can tell a lot of my clients are really changing. And I'll say, how do you know this? And they'll say, oh, well, you can just tell from what's going on in the group. And I have to say to them, oh, no, you can't. That's a really serious mistake. So fortunately, you know, I came into the field with this experience of spending hours a week counseling the abusers, but then getting the real story from the woman. So I was constantly being reminded what an extreme contrast there is between how he portrays what's going on and what is actually going on, what the ugliness actually is of mm-hmm. his behavior day to day. So that shaped my perspective from the very beginning, is that the image that comes to my mind when I think about domestic violence in many ways is more the offender than the victim. I mean, it's both. It's the woman, mm-hmm. it's the children. But in some ways, what I see most in my head is he's the cause of the problem. And people get confused about where does domestic violence come from? And I always say,
it takes two to tango.
Right. And I always say domestic violence comes from domestic violence perpetrators. That's where it comes from. So then we started to gradually, it took longer than it should have, frankly, but we started to gradually realize how much harm our clients were doing to children in the home. And one of my early heroes and supervisors, this advocate, Carol Souza, was one of the people that most pressured the counselors at Emerge, at my program. Like, you've got to look at what's happening to the kids in these, like, they're there, you know? Mm-hmm. Even if he never lays a hand on them, they're watching and absorbing everything he's doing to their mother. And then that led me to start to understand that they're also polluting children's relationships with their mothers. They're not just harming the children directly, but they're also causing huge problems between these kids and their moms. And in some ways, that's what's doing the greatest harm to the kids, is the way that they're damaging mother-child relationships. So all these things were dawning on us and dawning on me gradually. They really took quite a while. But once we started to understand how toxic the domestic abuser is to kids in the home, then we started to think, well, wait a minute, what does that mean post-separation? And my time coming into the domestic violence field coincided with the rise in the United States of the battering fathers movement, what's called the father's rights movement, but it's really mm-hmm. What I call the father supremacy movement. It's like more parenting time for batterers movement is what it is. And for child sexual abusers, for that matter. So around the same time that awareness was finally coming to me, these guys were starting to be out on street corners with their leaflets. You know, fathers are being discriminated against in the family courts, crying, all I want is to see my children. A whole very persuasive, heart-rending routine, yeah. Unless you actually investigate the cases that you're being handed these leaflets about. And most people, of course, don't ever investigate the actual cases. And so then this coincided with the partners of our clients, the victims in our cases, starting to more and more report to us that our clients were hassling them about court-ordered visitation, or were increasingly even going after custody. So all these things kind of brought this first tiptoeing and then stampeding into my life as I started to see more and more of these cases and be so disturbed by their outcomes, and started to go into certain cases in great, great depth and reading the court documents, and a couple cases I had connections to. So then I was speaking to the evaluators and starting to be really disturbed by where these evaluators were coming from.
Yeah.
All the different techniques they had, which for dismissing really good evidence and for dismissing what women were saying and dismissing what children were saying. So these things all started to pile up on top of each other.
Yeah. And it is, it's, you don't know. And then when you get that little peek into that world, and then it comes flooding, all the stories that I've heard now and that the survivors that I work with and in my community. And it is appalling when you actually pull back the curtain.
And it's an increasingly airtight system where they have the psychological evaluators, the custody evaluators, the so-called parenting coordinators, the reunification therapists. They're starting to have this tight language, a system of thought that allows them to dismiss any concerns that arise about the abuser's behavior. They've got ways to account for almost anything a child would report. They've got ways to blame mom for almost anything that's turning up in a child's behavior. It's a system that really needs to be completely taken apart.
Torn down.
Right. It's almost not a reformable system. It really has to just be completely rebuilt from the bottom up. And the longer this has been going on, the more of a cash cow, unfortunately, it's becoming. Like the attorneys and custody evaluators, psychological evaluators, all these different roles that I just listed off, these people are making money just hand over fist. And one thing that to me is quite striking about what happens in family law processes, and I haven't found any other line of work where this is true, the worse you do your job, the more money you make. And
yes,
that's there's an inherent conflict of interest in these people getting paid for what they're doing, because a custody evaluator whose intervention quickly leads to a resolution of the case doesn't make very much money. A custody evaluator whose recommendations cause this thing to drag on for years and years and who keeps getting reappointed to do updated evaluations, and friends of his or friends of hers are psych evaluators and reunification therapists, and so they're getting, I mean, it's just this money is just going all over the place. The more that you cater to the abuser, and the more that the children get harmed, the more that the mom gets harmed, the more everybody is raking in money.
Yeah. Yeah, I have an experience where I was called to testify, and so I couldn't be in the courtroom during this hearing till it was my turn. And so I'm sitting out in the hallway reading my book, and the dad, who was the abusive person in this situation, and his attorney come out, and they're standing literally right next to me talking about the case. And he was actually in this space of, no, I think that I'm comfortable with this kind of collaborating or coming to a decision that was not solely in his interest. It was collaboration. And the attorney was like, okay, well, if you want her to win. And she said just that little bit of language and he got all riled up. No, I'm not wanting her to win. Is that what this is? Whereas he was completely in a place of agreement. Like, I'm sure he wasn't excited about whatever that decision was, but his attorney had to say that one something that allowed the case to just continue and continue and continue. And this attorney made lots of money off of this case solely because of how she interacted with this parent who's abusive. It was really eye-opening to sit there and just watch. And they didn't know who I was, right, until I got on the stand. And then I'm sure they were not happy about them talking right next to me. But yeah, it was insane to sit there and just hear this.
And you're really pointing to another really essential question, which is how come 30 years ago abusers were so willing to pretty much let it go, not because they cared about the kids, but precisely because they didn't really care that much about the kids, and they're selfish the way abusers are, and they don't want a bunch of responsibility for the kids, and they just wanted to go on with their lives. And you know what happened? And I would say it's a whole series of things. One of the things, unfortunately, is that collection of child support got very, very strict. And mm-hmm. at the time, that seemed like a great thing. I was totally for it myself. Like, oh yeah, we got to crack down on people who aren't paying child support because it should be a good thing. Except it turns out not to be a good thing because it awakened a sleeping giant. Because as soon as abusers were really being forced to pay child support, then they want to retaliate. Abusers are highly retaliatory. That's one of their essential qualities, is how retaliatory they are. They want to get women back for stuff. And they don't care if their revenge process harms the children, or some abusers do, but most abusers don't care if their revenge process harms the children. And so that's part of what got them revved up, but that's not all of it. You know, the internet did a lot to get them revved up because they started to connect with other abusers on the internet and share their, you know, their hatred of women together and share their stories, making themselves the victims at when their horrible actions were the cause of it all. And so that starts to really rev them up. And there start to be these horrible books like, I don't even want to say the titles of them, that are designed to rev abusers up about their court cases. So now it's, rather than the abuser who goes for custody being the exception, he's become much more the rule. Now the abuser who just lets it go has become the less common thing. And they're all just, you know, getting really cranked up.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a totally different, you know, ball game when you're in it and you can see everything going on. And so if we look at reform, court reform is, you know, people are, you know, shouting from the rooftops that we need it. So in Colorado, this last session, we had Caden's Law sponsored and it passed in Colorado. And so I'm not sure how familiar you are with it in Colorado, but it is federal as well with the Violence Against Women Act and things like that. But just kind of your thoughts on, is this kind of legislation going to do anything? How is it going to help, and what needs to shift to have it have more of an impact?
So my answer about whether passing legal reforms is important or not is going to be yes and no. And I'm really glad you did it. I think it's really important work. I think it creates a whole platform for making arguments. You can refer to the law. But I'll say a fair bit about this. First of all, it's not going to do what many people are hoping it would do in itself. That somehow once we've got this law, that's really going to change things. One thing that I can just say so strongly from my 25 years now of observing family law processes is that the family law judges really care about the law when it's their excuse to do what they want to do. They'll say, oh, you know, I'm sorry, ma'am, but the law requires me to do such and such. Suddenly they seem very strict about the law. And then when the law is telling them not to do what they want to do, then they just ignore the law. It's like the law didn't exist. And what they do a lot with laws about domestic violence is just say, well, I don't believe this is a domestic violence case. Well, the law can't require them to say it's a domestic violence case. They'll say, no, we've looked into this and we don't believe her allegations. They do this over and over again when they haven't actually done any kind of proper. Mm-hmm. But the fundamental point that I would really emphasize for people is work on passing a law in order to build your movement. Don't build your movement in order to pass the law. I encourage people, in other words, to reverse how they're thinking about that. In other words, when you're finished passing a law, you want to think, this, we have just begun. Like passing this law helped us build all these connections. It helped us cultivate some activists. It helped some women feel more powerful. Now, where are we going with that in order to bring about actual cultural change and in order to actually figure out how do we pressure the family court and the attorneys and the evaluators to actually have to change what their actions are? And I was concerned by what happened with Connecticut, because Connecticut passed something, Jennifer's Law, that was that had a lot in common with Caden's Law. And when it was passed, some key leadership in the passing of that law said, well, now our work is done. We got the law passed. Now we need to shut up and build peaceful relationships and get along with everybody and stop being so militant. Now we're on the inside because our law is passed. We have to be polite and go back to being ladies. Mm-hmm. And it was a tremendous mistake. It was a tremendous mistake. They had built a really strong movement in Connecticut and allowed it to fizzle. And of course, Connecticut judges are some of the worst in the country, and they're just right back to their usual stuff, as if the law wasn't even there. There's also a coercive control law, and I forget if that's part of the same law or if that's two different laws in Connecticut. So very valuable, but we have to think about how do we dramatically increase our numbers. Connie Valentine from the California Protective Parents Association, who's been an activist on this issue longer than I have been, 30 years, she drafted a book that really gave the whole history of the battle for the custody rights of abused moms and protective moms of all kinds, you know, moms whose kids are being sexually abused. And that book documents such good strategy, such clever efforts, all different kinds of things that people thought of to try as ways of protesting. I mean, it's really good stuff that's in that book. And she also keeps saying, and we didn't win that much. And so what I came away from reading that manuscript convinced that the main thing we've got to do is we've got to get our numbers way, way up. We have to get way more people involved. If a few people are able to get a law passed, that's just not going to do anything because it doesn't increase our numbers. If your organizing for Caden's Law in Connecticut really allowed you to build up numbers, that's excellent. Then the conversation just needs to continue. Okay, now what do we do? How do we put more direct pressure on the court, picketing the court, blockading the court, mm-hmm. whatever? How do we start shaming publicly the judges for what they've done? The international human rights movement, which is, you know, all over the world, relies very heavily on public shaming. That's really in many ways, is their number one tactic, is public accountability for state actors. And by state actors, they mean any government. They don't just mean mm-hmm. sense of a united state, like a country is a state, you know, in that terminology. So, you know, we need to be exposing judges by name. There was this time in New Jersey when the women were all out at a picket with these T-shirts that had the judge's face printed on the T-shirt. Like that's the kind of action that we have to be taking. We have to start publicly shaming these custody evaluators some of you have probably heard these cases where a couple custody evaluators, it hasn't happened nearly enough, but a couple of custody evaluators have been exposed for corruption after 20 years of damaging women's lives and were put out of business. Some of them have been exposed and not really put out of business, which is even more.
Yeah.
Like, do those women get to now get their children back who were, it's like, no, not exactly. So we need to push forward with exposing what these evaluators are doing. Anyhow, we can talk more about, there are a number of different tactics that we can talk about how do you put pressure on the system besides just the passing of laws. But I'm all for the passing of laws. I think it's great. Just pass the law in order to build your movement. Don't build your movement in order to pass the law.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a conversation with Representative Meg Froelich, who sponsored the bill here in Colorado, and she, a couple of years before that, had sponsored Julie's law, and she's really wonderful, but she's also honest of this is an incremental thing. This is a slower process, and we have to keep building on this. And I think here in Colorado, because it tried to be passed in, I think, as Montana, and it was a bust. I know they just had, I think it was just yesterday when we're recording this, in California, there was a big Pinky's law was passed through the judicial committee. So there's some change. But I think in Colorado, the reason it was a big win here is because we have had some pretty negative press and publicity about our system here in Colorado. Mark Kilmer is here in Colorado. And so there was a huge story of that. And then they looked at our entire evaluation system here and all the evaluators and what's going on. And so I think you're right that there needs to be that exposure, a wide exposure of what's going on, because nobody wants that negative press. Nobody wants that negative publicity. And so I think that that primed Kaden's law for passing potentially. It was like, ooh, we don't want any more of that. Colorado looks horrible, right? Like, we look horrible. We don't want that. So yeah, I agree that accountability, putting it out into the public eye, not just those of us that are passionate about it. We need other people to become passionate about it, not just the handful of mental health professionals and legal professionals to be involved.
And we really, you know, we need moms, we need protective moms to as much as possible to be at the front of our movement. But that's so hard for them because they're trying to raise their kids, you know, and
yeah,
fight their legal battles. And a lot of them can't be public because judges are so openly retaliatory against women who go public. In fact, they'll tell women that shows that they're not good moms, that they're taking the issue public and use that as an excuse to take more time away from her. Some moms, their cases can't get any worse. And so they simply go public, and other moms, you know, their read of their own situation is that they think they can get away with a certain amount of public action, but it's dicey. But we've, you know, there was another picket that I know about, I forget where it was, where the women wore masks, which was had a great effect because it meant that they could be there, and simultaneously they were sending the message, this is how retaliatory judges are, that I can't be here and actually show my face. And then I think in order to take this system apart, we're going to have to address how much money is being made, because otherwise, when people are making just hundreds of thousands of dollars, they're going to find a way to keep doing that. They're going to find their way to work around laws. They're going to find a way to pollute what's in the media and so forth to, you know, spin things. And so that's one of the things we really want to focus on. Like, one of the fundamental reforms that I want us to be demanding is that all billing for any court-related activity should have to go through the court. In other words, if the court appoints a custody evaluator, the court should have to pay the custody evaluator, and then the court should have to charge the people. Or at the very least, the custody evaluator should have to present the bill to the court, and the court gives the bill to the people. That's actually my second choice. My first choice is the court should have to pay it, and they should have to collect from the parents.
Mm-hmm.
But at the very least, the bill should have to go through the court, because the courts don't even realize and don't seem to care what these people are charging the parents. And so parents will say, well, I just got this bill for $20,000 from custody evaluator who has not met with my children, or maybe not 10,000 from this custody evaluator who has not met with my children. So that issue has to be addressed, where there's very clear public accountability, where any, you know, because court records are public records, right? Like, I can go see what's in a case, and I can see what the allegations are. I can see what the defenses are against those allegations. but I can't see what anyone's being paid.
Yeah.
And that all needs to become part of the public record, where it has to be shown in the file. Everyone, the attorney, exactly what that attorney's been paid. The any evaluators appointed by the court, or if the, even evaluators that the parties agreed to voluntarily, it's got to be in the record what those people are being paid. I believe that's one of the reforms that would take the system apart the most quickly.
Yeah, I think that's great, because here, and I don't know if it's everywhere, but here in Colorado, CFIs, I don't even know when it was, years ago, there was a cap put on how much they could charge. And then all of a sudden, just like you said, there's going to be some maneuvering. And now all of a sudden, the PRE industry is a lot bigger, whereas before, and I'm kind of from this outside perspective of I have contact with these other, you know, these court professionals, but I'm not like in their world per se. And so for a long time, it was, I had spoken to one PRE over 5 years of right in private practice. And that was seemed like this odd thing. And now that there's been a cap on how much a CFI can charge, all of a sudden I'm talking to a heck of a lot of PREs.
Sorry, could you tell me what these initials are? Because these are state by state.
Oh, yeah. So like, who is it? Child Family Investigator. So they are, they, and this is also, right, like it makes me anxious thinking about it. You don't have to be like a mental health professional to be a child family investigator. So you could be in a, you could be anything. You could just like take this training and become one. But they are like the lower level, like master's level trained. And then the PREs until recently, they were all PhD and MD level. And so, yeah, before, and that's the parental responsibility evaluator. So they are now, I'm getting a ton of communication with PREs rather than CFIs. So it just kind of show, and my clientele hasn't really shifted, right? All of a sudden, I'm not working with extremely affluent individuals that can afford that. It, there's been that shift since there's been a cap.
Interesting. And one of the questions that I've wanted to raise, Sybil, is what sort of training does a custody evaluator need? Because the, when someone says, oh, we have completely untrained custody evaluators, I think, well, actually, your very trained custody evaluators are also completely untrained with respect to whatever actually matters. And I actually made a list of what a custody evaluator needs to know. And there's no such credential. There's no such field. A mental health professional actually isn't any better prepared on average than an attorney. The people that I've seen the best do the best investigations are probation officers.
Mm.
It was just simply because they had investigative skills. and in some ways, what matters is to be a good investigator. So that's one of the questions that we need to go into is what actually qualifies someone to be an evaluator. And I actually think they need to have no requirement for credentials, except they actually have been taken a training for evaluating.
Yeah, done really good at training on what they're looking for.
But that would include a lot of training on abuse, because none of these people have any training on abuse or neglect or child sexual abuse. They know nothing about the most important issues in the, or parenting. The funny thing is these people usually have no background in how you assess parenting. And so they try to guess how good a parent is by doing a mental health evaluation of somebody. Well, mental health evaluations have zero scientific validity for predicting how good a parent someone will be. They're good for nothing, literally nothing, in predicting the quality of somebody's parenting. So there's a lot of questions here that haven't even begun to be looked at. The whole system is operating on a whole set of myths.
Yeah, and that transparency piece, specifically again with the Mark Kilmer case, it's like fresh in Colorado minds, is he was found to be doing really horrific things. And like some of the reports that were written were just copied from someone else's and the names changed. And sometimes the names weren't changed and ages of children were wrong and things like that. And yet, because he's a mental health professional, that is overseen by the Department of Regulatory Agencies. I think it's what DORA stands for. But they don't want to touch it because it's like, oh, well, that's like court stuff. That's not mental health stuff. And the court's like, well, he needs to be like, DORA needs to figure this out because he's got these letters after his name. And so nobody wants to touch it with regard to accountability.
And that brings us back to, you know, how do we get the numbers up enough in our movements that we start to be able to really pressure all these agencies, that we start to be able to have enough power with our legislators, that we start to be able to have enough pressure on bar associations, where these people suddenly start to feel like, the custody rights people are coming. We better actually do something about what we're doing. So So I'm really interested in being part of national conversation about how do we train activists? How do we actually develop strategy? Because we have a tendency to analyze the problem to death. And we actually do need to spend some time analyzing the problem. It's not that we shouldn't analyze the problem, but we have a tendency to just analyze the problem, not talk about, okay, where are the weak points in the system? Where could we fight back? How do we cultivate more activists? How do we help women take care of themselves and take care of each other through the process of being an activist? Because we tend to grind our activists up. The court is already grinding up these women's lives and these children. Mm-hmm. How do we cultivate more activism among children who are survivors of the system? There are a few children out there who are very outspoken, but they've never had any place to really plug in and kind of get brought into a fold. And okay, we're going to give you a forum. We're going to create a whole context in which you can really tell your story and in which we can use the power of your story to make things happen. I've been at quite a number of national conferences on this issue, but I would love sometime to do a national meeting that was completely activist oriented. Like, okay, we're not mm-hmm. here to solve the problem. We all get what the problem is, but let's talk strategy, movement building, emotional support, and so forth. Like the real nuts and bolts would be an awesome conversation. It seems like we have a lot to learn from what you've done in Colorado, Sybil. It sounds like other states could benefit a lot from your efforts there. I think there are things to be learned from what happened in Connecticut. There are obviously so many things to learn from 30 years of activism in California by the California Protective Parents Association. And they work closely now with this excellent California group, the Center for Judicial Excellence, which for kind of it's something that's really set up as a nonprofit. They, to me, are the most effective national organization coming from the being an established agency sort of thing, different from being like a grassroots activist group. The Center for Judicial Excellence has just been outstanding. So that's another resource to draw upon, and it's another model to draw upon as a way of doing things and building your advocacy.
Yeah, and I think the piece that I really appreciate you bringing up is the support for the advocates and for anyone who is speaking out, because I think that's what's missing, right? In a lot of just nonprofits in general or advocacy, people get burnt out. They just get, there's vicarious trauma, and they just get completely burnt out, and then their work just stops. Right? Because they can't do it anymore. And so, yeah, how can we support those kind of on the front lines doing that work, that advocacy work? And how can we tag team when we need to? And what I've seen in, I don't know, the last probably 7 or 8 years, I've been much more involved in kind of the advocacy and speaking loud and meeting people and connecting with people. But what I see is everyone is working in silos, and people aren't coming together. If they disagree on one or two things, but their overall goal is the same, they seem to stay separate because of those one or two things that they don't fully agree on. And so I think that is, and I've spoken about it on LinkedIn, I've posted about it and things like that. I think that is harming this particular movement. I'm sure it's harming lots of movements, but I think that it's really causing harm.
Ideological purity is harming all kinds of movements. You're pointing to a really significant current problem. I won't work with so-and-so because they don't have the right line on such and such a subject. It's but if you agree with them on your 6 points that you care about, why don't you just work with them on your 6 points that you care about? And so, yes, I think that's a huge issue. With post-trauma effects are just a huge issue. I notice a lot in my couple decades of trying to help do custody rights organizing, how much energy from survivors ends up going into taking pieces out of each other instead of taking pieces out of the system. That's post-trauma playing out there and internalized oppression. And I've created an organization called the Peak Living Network that I've just created in recent years. That's my main reason for creating that organization was trying to create a place where activists could take emotional care of one another. And that organization is lots of other things as well. But that's really what's driving me to want, that's what drove me to create that organization, is exactly what you're saying, that activists need way more support and caretakers need way, advocates in general need way more support. People who are taking these issues on, as you're saying, they just get ground up. And one thing that really concerns me too is that the system solution to that currently is to tell people to take better care of themselves and say, okay, well, here's what you need to do for self-care. And there's still nothing about, well, how do we take better care of each other? Mm-hmm. And so that's why I created the Peak Living Network, is to be about not like, how do you go off and take better care of yourself? How do we get much better at taking care of each other?
Absolutely. And it's the reason I started the Rising Beyond community is healing happens so much quicker when you have people around you who get it, like safe people who you don't have to defend yourself. You know, like they believe you, because some of these stories are unbelievable. And so just that natural, like that safe space to be with each other and to heal with each other, alongside each other, is so, I mean, I'm like always honored to just sit back and just watch the groups that I run or whatever, just them support each other. It is so important and so awesome. And so, yeah, if you all are driving or folding laundry or whatever, all of the things that we're going to talk about, any of those resources, we are going to put them in the show notes. So don't worry about trying to write everything down. We'll do that. And with that, I want to shift to, it's a little bit of a different resource, but Lundy Bancroft has written a novel. I don't know if y'all know about that. I have read it. And actually my mom read it too. I gave it to her because she likes those kind of mystery type books as well. So she's not like in this movement or world, but she really enjoyed the book too. But yeah, share a little bit about In Custody.
Thank you, Sybil. So yeah, I've been asked many times over the years to write a book about what's going on in the child custody system. And I've been reluctant to do it. And I've been reluctant to do it because I think it'll be a very, very heavy book. It does need to be written, but it'll be a very hard book to read. And I'm concerned that not that many people will read it. And I felt like, you know, sometimes a novel reaches more people about a subject than a book about the subject does, because it's more entertaining. And so I decided, you know what, I'm going to write a mystery and suspense novel that's related to what's going on in the family law system. So that's what led to this novel, In Custody. So it's about a mom and daughter who go missing in the midst of a custody battle. And there are really strong signs that they left voluntarily, and there are really strong signs that they did not leave voluntarily. And that leaves the law enforcement pretty stumped about what happened, and the media pretty stumped about what happened. And so the novel is really a story of a young intern who gets at a newspaper, who gets put on this story because her editor assumes that it's going to just be like a million other stories where 4 days later the people turn up again and it turns out their car broke down in the mountains or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they've been like hiking for 3 days to get back, whatever it is, you know, and he just assumes it's a nothing story. So he hands it to his intern. And then when it turns out to be a big story for a number of reasons, he has trouble taking it away. He wants to take the story back away from her and give it to one of his seasoned reporters. But for a number of reasons, that turns out to be extremely difficult to do. And so she becomes this, she has no idea what she's doing, but she just kind of starts fighting her way through. And it's really the story of her trying to figure out what's going on. And you're fairly far into it before you start to learn some things about what's actually going on in the family law system. In fact, it's a long time before she even really realizes it has anything to do with what's going on in the family law system. So I tried not to like hit people over the head with the ideas. You know, it's like, I tried to just tell a good suspenseful story. I've heard it's hard to put down, which that's music to my ears. That's my favorite thing to hear. You write a suspense novel, of course you want to hear that it's hard to put down. And I'm also, believe it or not, I mean, people who don't know me may be surprised by this, but I'm actually a real joker. And so I tried to bring some of that into the book, mm-hmm. too, just making the kind of cracks that I'm inclined to make. And try to just not make it like, oh my God, this is so, I mean, there are heavy parts of the book. I don't want to mislead people. There are books, there are parts of this book that are hard to read, but it's not what you're doing the whole time. I tried to write a book that isn't just dark the whole time. You're not just like slogging through this really hard stuff. And my dream about it, we'll see if this comes true, but my dream about it is for this to be a book that a woman who's in the family law system can hand to people in her life and say, here, read this suspense novel. It'll be entertaining. And when you're done reading it, you'll understand what's going on in my court case. mm-hmm. And we'll see if that happens or not. But that'd be my my real dream about it would be that it would be a way to reach people who don't understand the issue.
Yeah, and in a way that they would be on board with. I agree that the writing of, like, I wrote an ebook back, oh my gosh, now it's been like 5 or 6 years, because I was like, I need to train mental health professionals on working with this. And it was like this fire under me. And so I just wrote this, you know, this ebook and put it out there. And a lot, the majority of the people that were reading it were like, yeah, Sybil, preach, because they already knew, right? They were the ones that already knew the thing. And so it was like, you know, the handful of people who didn't know and responded were like, wow, oh, I had no idea. But I think, you know, writing the nonfiction, like, this is the family court system, you know, how the family court system devastates families, or whatever your clickbait title would be on there, would be people like me reading it. And I already know, I'm in there, I'm doing the thing. And so I do, I think it was it's a really creative way to get it to the masses, which is what we were talking about before, is like the masses need to know, not just the people in it.
So here's hoping. We'll see if it gets out to, we'll see if it gets out to a lot of people. One thing that I like people to know about this issue who are interested in reform is, you know, there are a lot of issues that, you know, beliefs that you may have about the world where, like, before you can bring about reform, like, first you have to even convince people to agree with you on the subject. And, like, so that's your first battle. This is not true in the family law case. Like, as soon as we explain to people what's happening, 90% of people are immediately with us. It's not that they disagreed with us. It's that they didn't know it was happening.
Yeah.
So I run into very few people who defend what the family law system is doing, other than the abusers.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, even men, I find, aren't, if they're not abusers, are not much inclined to defend this. They'll hear what's going on and say, that's horrible. And so that is a strength that we have, which is we don't have to convince people. We just have to inform them of what's going on. And that's a challenge. I'm not saying that's not a challenge. That is a challenge. But that's a different challenge from having to convince people. It's like, no, all we have to do is let them know what's happening, and they're outraged. And they're like, their initial reaction is always, oh my God, I can't believe this is going on. In the novel, I actually, my journalist character comes across some true stories that are just right out of newspapers, where I just use the actual names and the actual facts from stories that were in the press. And you read those and, like, you can hardly believe these things. It's like, oh my God, I can't. You've made reference to this today already, Sybil, about you where these things, like, whoa, I can't believe this is happening. And that's part of why women don't get believed, is because it's, as you were saying, it's because it's so unbelievable. And so it's very important to give people these actual cases from the newspaper and say, look, like, yes, these things really do happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember when I was reading it, I was like, I know these names. I was like, I know these names. And I was like, oh, no, I know all of these names when I was reading it, because it is, it's, you know, it's like this, the sad stories that make it to the media. And then many don't make it to the media, but these are ones that if you're reading it, you might have heard, and they're true stories. They're real and true. And so, yeah, I really enjoyed the book. The link to that book is going to be in the show notes below us. So grab that. Lundy, do you have any other kind of, like, wrapping up, finishing thoughts that you really want to leave people with?
Oh, a couple that are really important to me. One is when you're a mom that's in litigation, you know, trying to protect your kids, you get so many messages that you're kind of revolting for your effort to fight for your kid. You know, you've got attorneys, even your own attorney so often is like acting like there's just something wrong with you, or you're being unreasonable, or you're being unfair, or this or that or the other thing. Of course, the abuser's attorney is acting like you're the most revolting thing on the planet. Custody evaluators often are talking in these extremely condescending, disrespectful ways. You're constantly being made to feel like you're the bad one. And so I'm very eager to tell moms, you are not the bad one. Your children desperately need you to be fighting for them the way you are. Someday they are almost certainly going to realize how valiantly you were fighting on their behalf. They may not realize it or appreciate it now, but I really believe the great majority of children do eventually realize that mom was fighting like hell for their well-being. Mm-hmm. You are so deserving of just admiration and respect for your courage, your intelligence, your tire. I mean, you've had so many sleepless nights, your ability to just go on fighting even when you haven't had any sleep, your ability to somehow continue fighting for what's right while everyone is making you feel like what you're doing is wrong. That in itself is really hard to do. So it's important to me to just get to express that, like, you're doing the right thing and they're the ones that are messed up. You're not the one that's messed up. And when these cases have been mishandled by enough different people, that makes the mom feel even worse. And you'll have people look at you again with that condescending, disgusted kind of way and saying, oh, you're saying you're the one that's right and 10 different professionals on your case got it wrong. And it's like, yep, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yes.
I'm saying these people all think the same. And not only that, but they told each other what to think. Part of why they all came to the same conclusions is because they told each other to come to these conclusions. But it's also because they're steeped in a lot of the same, you know, terrible anti-mother and anti-child theories that are shaping their entire paradigms. So, even if a whole series of people are getting it wrong, you're still getting it right. And thank you. Thank you for fighting for your kids' well-being in that kind of way and for respecting them and respecting their boundaries and fighting for them. And the other thing that I'll say is that I do think movement building is possible. I've seen very successful movements built. The example that comes to my mind a lot is Mothers Against Drunk Driving. When I was growing up, drunk driving was completely socially acceptable. It was illegal, but it wasn't enforced. Mm-hmm. It wasn't enforced very much. And socially, it was completely acceptable. You told a story about drunk driving, everybody laughed. People were kind of proud of you. They'd probably punch you on the arm. Like, it was kind of like, ooh, you were out, you know, sowing your wild oats or whatever, you know. And nowadays, you tell a story about driving drunk, people would be so disapproving of you. Like, that's yes. So irresponsible. You could have killed somebody. So you can change a whole culture. It took them decades to do it, but the Mothers Against Drunk Driving movement did change a whole culture. You can change laws. They changed laws, and they actually didn't just change laws, but they made changes where those laws actually started to be enforced. They did it by building a huge movement, and that's what we need to do. You know, we have to build a huge national and international movement, which is what we have not succeeded in doing in the past 30 years is actual movement building. But we can do it. And the Mothers Against Drunk Driving and other kinds of movements, labor unions, I mean, we can look to all kinds of places where people successfully build up enough numbers and enough loud voices and enough good strategies, because strategy is really important, mm-hmm. enough good strategies to successfully fight back. Another thing that happens with moms is that once they finally do have space to fight because their children are old enough, they're exhausted and just need to be able to enjoy their lives. But I think we can find ways to work with that. Say, no, we're not asking you to devote your whole life to this movement. Yes, you need a day at the beach after 10 years in this ugly court battle. But there are ways to keep you involved, and we're going to look after you. We're going to be here for you. It's going to be a loving environment. And we can create organizations that make activism sustainable. And I don't think we can do it in a month, but in a period of years, we can build the kind of movement that could go up against the kind of money that these people are making and bring these people down.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that letting people know that there is hope, because so many, you know, when they, you know, and I'm not like always rainbows and butterflies and unicorns. I'm pretty hopeful and positive most of the time, but there is a realistic piece to me and what I think about. But I run into the complete lack of hope because it has felt so, you know, so hard. But just know that there are people that are really trying to do the work, and that we are here when you're ready to join us.
And let me pipe in another thing about hope, which is that, you know, while moms are always being called the alienators, the real alienators are the abusers, and that I also see a lot of cases where children who've been turned against their mothers find their way back to mom. And I'm not promising. I know there are cases where the years go by and those kids don't find their way back to mom. But I see so many cases. I've done some writing about it on my blog, where, and I'm a very infrequent blogger, but I do blog from time to time, that where I tell some stories about times and specific cases I've been connected to, where moms have found their way back where kids have found their way back to mom. I've had a couple of very powerful stories from people I know, you know, through work that I do, people I've come to know personally, who've told me some very powerful recent stories about their kids finding their way back to them. So that's another thing to be hopeful about, is that those relationships so often can be repaired over time.
Yeah. Yeah. And you are, I talk about this a lot, but you are giving them the gift of perspective of, this is what unconditional love feels like. This is what, I using air quotes, you know, love with strings attached feels like. And they will very often turn towards unconditional love because it feels better to them, to their nervous system. It feels safe.
I think that's right. I think kids gradually start to really be able to tell the difference. You know, they're being seduced by certain things, particularly when they're teenagers. Teenagers want certain material things. They want a car. They want unsafe freedom.
Mm-hmm.
They're often getting at the abuser's house. And so those things are going to be very seductive to them for a period of time. But on a deeper level, we want exactly what you just said, Sybil. On a deeper level, we want unconditional love. And we want to be respected. And we even want to be able to fight with people and disagree with them and have them not reject us for the fact that we're struggling and disagreeing with them about stuff or in conflict with them about certain things. They're not going to get any of those things from the abuser, right? You're in conflict with the abuser. You're on the bad list, you know, and you're getting treated with this. Yeah, you're being given a car, but you're being disrespected in so many different ways. And so I think you're exactly right that so many kids over time start to figure out what's real and what isn't and what really matters in life and what doesn't. And that's one of the things that brings them back to their moms.
Mm-hmm.
Respect and genuine kindness and physical affection. I mean, a number of things tend to bring them back towards mom. So I think you're just over and over again so on point, Sybil. I really appreciate the things that you say on this issue. I find you very, really, really sharp and on point.
I'm having like a fangirl moment. Right? Like years ago, a decade ago, reading your book, it's funny because it's on my coffee table here in my office, and it's like got all the like post-its in it, and it's all bent and like highlighted and a huge mess. So that means the world to me. So I so appreciate you being here and taking some time to share your thoughts with my audience, because it matters, right? You all that are listening, you matter. And we want to let you know that we're working on it and that you do matter. So again, everyone, thank you for being here. And we will catch you on the next episode of the Rising Beyond podcast.
If you're healing from relationship abuse and are looking for support and sisterhood during this journey, I'd love to invite you to the Rising Beyond community, where you will get expert guidance, connection with others going through similar experiences, and a safe place where you'll always feel seen, heard, and believed. To learn more and to join, go to www.risingbeyondpc.com. We'd love to be a part of your healing journey.